This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
Kaiphthegma kai anemoen, phronema kai astu nomus, orgas edidaxato kai dusaulon, pagon hu paithria kai dosombra feugain bele. Pantoporos aporos ep uden erketai tomelon. Haida monon feuxin uk epaxetai. Noson dame canon fugas. Xum pephrasetai. Sophon tito me canoen technas huper elpid econ. Totemen kakon alot ep eslon erpe. Nomus garaion kathonos theon tenor condican. Hupsipulus apolis hoto to me calon, xunesti tolmas carin, metemoi parestios genoito metison phronon, hosta verde.
Hello, my name is Joseph, and welcome to episode 7 of Sophocles' Antigone in 2019. On this episode, I'll be looking at lines 354 to 383 of Sophocles' Antigone, of which I just read the first 20 lines. This section forms the second half of the first Stasimon, which contains the second strophe, antistrophe, and the epode. The Stasimon is also known as the Ode to Man. In this episode, I will be focusing on the meter of this section and showing how the meter emphasizes the theme of dualities in the section and the play at large. Speaking of dualities, my peer, Brendan, covered the first half of this ode, focusing on the word deinos and its two opposing meanings on the previous episode, episode 6. I encourage you to check it out. For context, this ode is sung right after Creon threatens the guard, who exits the palace to find the criminal that buried Polynices' corpse. After the ode, Creon finds out Antigone violated his edict. In the section of the ode I will be focusing on, the chorus contemplates how man built cities to escape the elements, how man can escape even disease, but cannot escape death. They praise the noble citizen and rebuke the exile. In the epode, they react to the entrance of Antigone, who is revealed as the one who buried her brother. What I think is really interesting about the strophe and antistrophe is the meter of the two are identical. Each has 10 lines, and the first line of each the meter is identical, and the second line of each the meter is identical. Let me read lines 360 through 370 again, so you can hear it for yourself. Line 360, Pantoporos aporos ep uden erketai. And line 370, Hupsipolis apolis hotoi tome kalon. So would any self-respecting artist have parallels in between two metrically identical stanzas that did not point to a larger theme? I think not. Pantoporos aporos translates to all inventive, unprepared. Hupsipolis apolis, honored citizen, exile. These two pairs of antonyms both occur in the sixth line of their stanzas and are metrically equivalent. By doing this, Sophocles builds dualities in the ode. One is either loved by the city or hated by them. Man is opposed to both nature and death. I think that the strophe even feels cold as it mentions frost, pagon, while the antistrophe is warm, mentioning a parestios, a hearth. The epitome of this probably occurs with the third word in the ode, deinos, which means both wonderful and terrible. The word is an antonym of itself. For more on this, again, I recommend you tune into the last episode of the podcast, where Brendan talks about the different meanings of deinos. In fact, we can see dualities across the play. Antigone and Ismene are sisters, but have opposing ideas on what to do about their brother's corpse. Antigone's grave is also a bridal chamber. Polynices and Anticles are brothers fighting on different sides of a war. By contrasting, we are comparing. How can we pick one side of a conflict when the two are presented to us as so similar in their opposition? One may think that by showing the duality, the chorus rises above it and cannot be swayed either way in black and white thinking. Tragically, this is not the case, as immediately following the antistrophe, they insult Antigone, calling her a dustenos kai dustenu patros oedipura, a wretched one, wretched daughter of wretched Oedipus. So all this talk of duality has me thinking of my ninth grade English class. In that class, we read the Bible as literature, and we looked at the creation story in Genesis. For those of you who don't know, God creates light,
He separates it from darkness. He creates the earth and he creates heavens and he separates them. He creates land and water and he separates them. And so what we were looking at in that ninth grade English class that took place so long ago is we were looking at dualities. We were looking at how light is opposed to darkness, how land is opposed to water. But we were maybe also looking at how light needs darkness. Can you call something light if you don't know what darkness is? And so when you've learned that, you can look back and you can say, okay, so what? This is a duality. What does that mean? These things are similar yet different. What does that mean? They might be two sides of the same coin. Let's look at a modern example of dualities. Let's take a political example. We can have an eco-terrorist who blows up oil refineries and does bad things. We can take an oil executive. And you can make the argument that because oil pollutes, that they're a bad person too. You can say these people are just two sides of the same coin. They might be opposed to each other and that they're both just doing bad. So they're basically the same, even though they're different. You can also do this. Another political example is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. You can say these are both people who are just fighting for land, for their nation, maybe for their religion or their families. And so they're actually both similar, even though it seems they're so different. And so when we use dualities in this way, it seems like we are rising above the distinctions and that we're kind of become enlightened now that we can see dualities. I think that argument is too easy to make, and I think it's wrong. When you make that argument, it looks like you don't have skin in the game, but you actually do. It makes it seem like you're not making a moral claim, but you actually are. You end up doing what you think that you're so above by saying, oh, these people are wrong, but I'm right. The only difference is that you think two people are wrong or two groups are wrong instead of one. And I do think that in a lot of cases, there is someone who is right and there is someone who is wrong. And that because you think you're not part of the conflict and you're above it, you're still making a moral claim. And especially I think that Sophocles realizes this. Throughout the play, we see that he creates the dualities. For example, we looked at the Ode of Man. We had Hoopsipolis and Opolis. We had Pontoporos and Operos. We had the coldness of the frost and the warmth of the hearth. We had man as opposed to nature. Looking more broadly, we have Creon as opposed to Antigone. And so they're locked in a battle. And so you can say, oh, you know, Creon and Antigone, they're just two sides of the same coin. They're people that just have different views about what the law should be. And that Sophocles is showing us that what they're doing is both bad because it's ultimately destructive. Look what happens in the end. You know, Antigone and Haman end up killing themselves. And I think that's wrong. I don't think that's what Sophocles is trying to show. I think that he's trying to show that to say it's a duality and that we are above it, you know, when you do that, you're ignoring the end of the play. You're ignoring what happens in the end. You're ignoring Creon's regret. And so what happens when Antigone and Haman end up committing suicide is Creon doesn't also commit suicide. And he doesn't celebrate as a victor. He breaks that duality that we think that he has been occupying since the play began because he regrets his actions. He realizes that they are right and that Antigone was right. And so Sophocles, I think, is by extension saying that Antigone was right in this conflict. So as Sophocles breaks the duality, he's showing that we're not talking about the ninth grade English duality anymore. We're not above it. The two sides may be the same and that they are in conflict and that they are in conflict for similar reasons, that they both want to obey law. But there is a right and a wrong to this conflict. And in the end, Antigone was right. As much as we can try, we are not above dualities. While preparing for my teacher of the day, I learned that the meter of the strophes and the antistrophes are identical to each other. I didn't know that going in, and it ended up being the focus of my assignment. I learned it while reading the commentary from Griffith. I also learned that when I was teaching, that translating in front of a class takes up a lot of time. And time management is really crucial when teaching a class. I didn't want to spend the majority of my time translating the passage. I expected to spend maybe 8 or 10 minutes of my 30-minute time slot translating, and then the rest could be for discussion. That's what I prepared for. I prepared for a majority for discussion. And so if I could do it again, if I could redo the teaching assignment, I would have the class translate in addition to scanning the lines that I gave them. And then I would walk around, help people translate and scan. And that would hopefully leave more time for discussion, because it's easier for everybody on their own to translate two lines than to go through it all as a class. After this assignment, I remember these lines because I really liked translating them. I liked the lines themselves. And I felt like I really got lucky getting these lines.